Welcome to today's episode about how to improve your relationship with food and body without restriction or fighting with the scales. Jenna Talida is a registered dietitian and a certified intuitive eating counselor. Hello and welcome to Beyond Diagnosis, a podcast to raise your awareness, decisions, and voice for alternative practices, so you can take back control of your health. I'm Rita DeMichelle, your host, a mindset and empowerment coach, and the founder of the Onus platform. Join me each week so you can create the health of your dreams. Welcome to the show, Jenna.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Wow, this is going to be a great topic to talk about. It's one that I think is a touch point for many, many women. I don't think there are many women who don't have some form of issue with eating or body image or emotional problem. You know, it's just huge. This is going to open a can of worms. So
yeah,
I really would like to start with, you know, let's start with, you know, the diet culture. And I know you've got a lot of opinions around the diet culture and how toxic it is. Because we live in that fat phobic world. And yet, as a society, you know, unhealthy foods are pushed onto us, and it's really pushed into our psyche, you know, a lot more effectively than what's considered a healthy food. How do you help your clients develop food neutrality? You know, stop the good versus the bad mentality. That's so damaging.
Yeah, that's a great question. So it is true. Marketing definitely has a huge impact on how we eat. And we get a lot of messages about eating in so many different ways, different ways we like the types of foods we're supposed to eat, how we're supposed to eat them, when we're allowed to eat them. And it could be for any type of food, whether it's a food that is held up as healthy and ones that might not be in a certain type of way. I don't usually look at it in that fashion anymore, but it is definitely pushed on us in a all the time. It's hard to get away from it because we get these messages around us nonstop. I'll give you an example, and this isn't necessarily like marketing per se, but there was one night that I wanted to just relax and watch something funny on TV. And there was a series that George Lopez recently put out. It was just this little funny sitcom or whatever. So I sat down to watch it. The very first episode of that show, and it was only maybe like 20 minutes long, there were three fat jokes in there. And one of them was made by a child. And so, like, we're constantly inundated with that. There was this other opportunity or other time that I had somebody coming over to my house to fix something. And we had a little bit of small talk before he got started. And he was telling me about his wedding that he was getting ready for. And then he dove into about how he's focusing on weight loss and doing all of this stuff and restrictive behaviors and whatnot. And of course I didn't touch that because I didn't want to get into it with him. But even just that, it was like, I couldn't even feel safe in my own house because this person was talking about how they needed to be smaller, you know, and that in order to be in their wedding. And I spent many years dealing with, you know, my own issues with body and working through my own eating disorder and feeling better about all of that. And unfortunately, we don't recover in a bubble. So we end up hearing all of this talk about how we have so much pressure to lose weight all the time. And we have so much pressure to eat in a very specific type of way. And there's fat shaming everywhere. And it's a very hard place to live in. So there's so much pressure to always think like that. And women get the brunt of it, but men get it too. They're not excluded from it. So that's, and there's so much more to dive into that. But to answer your question about the neutrality part, one of the things I talk about with clients is working on taking the morality out of food, because we tie so much morality to our food, and then we end up taking on that and thinking that that morality transfers to us because we eat it or we don't eat it. And so it and it what ends up doing it puts that food up onto a pedestal and gives it a lot more power than it deserves. So like you had mentioned like fast food or something at one point. So let's say that fast food was the bad food or whatever, and well, it puts it onto that pedestal. And what happens if somebody were to tell you, oh, you can't eat that, or oh, that's bad for you, or oh, you can only have it at this particular time in this particular amount or whatever, what's going to happen? Chances are you're going to start obsessing about it, and you're going to fall into this cycle that happens, this restriction cycle that goes on. The rule is put in place about whatever you're doing, the amount, the type, when you can have it. And then the deprivation starts building up. And that's where the obsession part is as well. And then it gets to this place where you just feel like you can't take it anymore. And that's when you might eat it quickly. You might eat to a place of uncomfortable fullness. You might hide while you're eating it.
That's what I
All
was
of
going
these
to say.
different
That's a
things.
common one, isn't it? People hide
Yes.
for the shame
Yeah.
because they feel shame. That
Exactly.
well,
And that's the thing.
they're made to feel. I mean, I don't believe anyone can make you feel something. There's a trigger in you, but the trigger has been put there because
Exactly.
of all the expectations.
Exactly. Those expectations and that morality piece that's attached to that particular food, and the fact that we think it transfers to us. So we end up having that where we eat at fast or uncomfortable or whatever, and then we have the guilt and the shame. And you're probably right, the guilt and the shame probably happens sooner than that, but it does happen and it's there. But the guilt and the shame can also trigger that cycle to start all over again, and then we start restricting in some sort of fashion, and the whole thing just keeps going, and it's this vicious, vicious thing. And so if we're able to look at food completely neutral, that there's no such thing as good or bad, what it does is it takes that power out of it, and it's just food. And yes, it still might be delicious, and yes, you might still really enjoy eating it, but it doesn't mean that you're bad for eating it. And so an analogy I like to use with people is a doorknob, okay? So I want you to imagine a doorknob when you're sitting there judging yourself about your food. A doorknob is a very boring piece of metal, right? It's just going to let you in from one space to another. That's all that a doorknob is going to do. It's not going to go do volunteer work, and it's not going to go rob a bank, right?
You wish it would.
It would be awesome, it could help out around the house a little bit, but it's not going to go do those different things. And if you can understand that concept of that doorknob, then you can transfer that over to your food. And because food is an inanimate object and it's boring, really. I mean, it might be delicious and it, might have different components or whatever to it, but in actuality, it's an inanimate object, and it's not going to go do volunteer work or go rob a bank. It's just food. right? And the cool thing is about, well, let me say it this way. When we sit there and we place morality onto that food, that means that we have the power to remove it. And so that's what I look at as the cool thing. Not the fact that it's being placed on, but the fact that we have the power to say, you know what? It's really not a bad thing. I'm not a bad person because I want to eat a chocolate chip cookie. I'm not a bad person because we're going to go get some pizza tonight or something. It doesn't mean any of that, like that I'm a bad person or that I'm a good person because I had carrot sticks for lunch, you know? It's sure, have carrot sticks. That's awesome. It's going to help support your body in different kinds of ways, but it doesn't mean that you're morally superior than somebody who had a chocolate chip cookie.
So I think the problem is in society, that is what people think. They
It is.
start with you have no willpower, you know, have no self-esteem, you have no dedication to self, you're lazy, you're weak-minded, that is one of the problems.
And that's something that diet culture has drilled into our head about all of those misnomers. We're not lazy. We're not all of those things. We could actually be the most productive person in the world. We just happen to enjoy food that is delicious. And I'm not saying that we eat that at the expense of everything else. We do eat things that will help support our body so we can feel well and things like that. And we can feel well about our bodies, but the fact of the matter is that it's drilled into our head by diet culture that we have to eat based on how they say we're supposed to eat. And instead, it's about coming into our own bodies and listening to our own bodies, because that is what nobody knows how hungry or full we are, or what's going to be satisfying for us, or what we might have access to at that time, or what the situation is in front of us. Maybe we're having a celebration of some sort. Maybe that's a way of connecting with people. Maybe that's what's going to be comforting to us in that particular moment, and we didn't have anything else that could be comforting in that time. The fact is that nobody else knows that information except for our own selves. And being able to come into that and recognize those things, that's what diet culture doesn't like. Diet culture likes having control over us. But it oversteps its boundaries by coming in and trying to tell us what we're supposed to be, you know? And yeah, so, and I know this is like a very different way of thinking about things because it's really just easy to sit there and feel bad about how we're doing things, that we're always doing things wrong. But maybe if we give ourselves a little room to breathe and be flexible and be humans and be ones who actually enjoy our foods, we can have a much different relationship with it. Hearing this, I can understand if people are screaming at their devices and they're like, Jenna, what are you talking about? You know, you're gonna lose control, like you're never gonna stop eating these different things. And it might feel like that at first, but that's not necessarily because the food has any sort of problem or because you have any sort of problem with that. It's because the food has been limited from you for so long, you don't have trust that that will always be available to you. And when you know that that's going to be available to you, then your body starts wanting a variety of all different kinds of things, you know, based off what you like and what you have access to and what you tolerate. Your body loves a variety. It doesn't like just sticking with the same things over and over again. But it's really more about all the fear mongering and things like that that happen, like, oh my God, you ate a burger? Oh my God, you're the worst person in the world. Why are you doing that? Or, oh my God, you have diabetes. That means you can never eat dessert again. That's a bunch of fear mongering. And that's like, doesn't mean that people, you know, can't have certain types of things, you know? So.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's a huge subject and it's broad. And
Yeah.
if we can sort of circle back to what you were saying before we move on, you know, there's so many elements to it. There's the shaming, there's the whole morality issue. And I think also where a lot of the judgment can come in is that if someone is not in a larger body, well, if that's how you know, if that's correct in saying it, they just cannot understand how you could possibly be happy in a larger body. Because we're taught that overweight is bad and slim is good. You see, you know, in commercials and advertisements, all the rest of it, they're running along the beach. You know, they're all got the perfect body. Now you're starting to see the diversity. But
Exactly.
I think what's happening from that toxic body, you know, culture and diet culture, please correct me if I'm wrong, it also went into the lack of diversity, the lack of neurodivergent people in commercials, in, you know, in all a range of things, in employment
Exactly.
and everything. So to have this diverse range of looking people in society was not embraced. It
Exactly.
is a little
That's
bit more
a
now.
it's and yeah, you're right. And I'm very happy to start seeing that. And in answer to the first part of what you were just saying, thin bodied people or smaller body people look at fat body people, or even fat body people look at other fat body people and be like, how can you be okay with that? You know? And what actually has been shown is that it's not necessarily the fat body that is what affects our happiness or whatever, or our health. It's actually the weight stigma that comes along with it. It's the fact that everybody has this negative mindset towards people in fat bodies, and they have all of that description that you were just explaining. The lazy, blah, 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 every negative thing you could think of. They have that perception that that's what it means to be a fat person. But fat people are just another person. It's like having a different shoe size, or like having green eyes instead of brown eyes. It's just part of who we are, and we exist. It's just that we've because of the second part of what you were mentioning about in our viewpoint, everything that's been presented to us has always been a thin person exhibiting all of this stuff. They always have the happy endings. They're always the ones in the rom-coms. They're always the glamorous Hollywood stars. You know, they're everything. And we never had the diversity that actually showed every like the real world around us. And so we all looked at those kinds of people as that's the model of glamour, that's the model of happiness, and that's the model of health, when it really wasn't. It was just one type of person that was being displayed and being told, like you heard a story surrounding that body. And also, fat people are also the butt of the joke most of the time in those kinds of stories. They're usually the comedians or, you know, the people who aren't taken seriously. But it doesn't mean that they're the butt of the jokes. It just means that that's how they're displayed because people have this vision of fat phobia that they're looking through.
Absolutely.
So,
Yeah,
yeah.
that's a great answer. That's, you know, which leads me to my next one around that judgment and everything. You know, we're taught by health practitioners and, you know, health in general, that being overweight puts you more at a risk for stroke, heart attack, metabolic disorders. There's a long is there's a paragraph of symptoms or
Every,
diseases
maybe
that
you could write a book,
Come
probably.
with, they say it comes with being, you know, of a larger size or overweight. Let's just say overweight. Yet you advocate for fat positive, for being like that fat positive attitude. How do you deal with that pushback?
Yeah. Okay. Well, for one thing, our diet culture and our medical community are very tightly, like closely tied to each other. They both make lots of money off of our insecurities. And also there's another aspect too, that when, because these different things that you were talking about, the different conditions or whatnot, those are usually pulled from research. But what happens when we're reading research is that because those papers are not necessarily the most interesting, and they tend to talk at a very high level that most people don't understand the language, some most people will try to cut to the chase and figure out like what's the main gist of this research paper. And as a result, what tends to happen is that the data is misinterpreted. And one of the things that's misinterpreted about it is that a lot of those papers are based off of correlation and how we interpret them, because it's just easier to do it this way, is that we make it causation. And the difference between those, correlation means that there's a relationship between two things. Causation means that one thing led to another. And so that's kind of just how we are. We are always looking for why did this happen? Why did this happen? And these research papers make it out to seem weight caused this problem. That doesn't mean that's what it means. It means that these two things happen together. It could be that it was the opposite. It could be that the condition led to the weight. It could be that there were a million other variables that weren't even investigated that contributed to both of those issues. And not that necessarily weight is an issue, but just in the to simplify it, but that's the thing, is that it's not necessarily that those two think that one led to the other, and that by fixing the weight, that means that this problem is going to go away. It doesn't mean that at all. It just means that these two things tend to happen together. And the thing that I always love to fall back on is smaller body people also get these conditions too.
That's
And
exactly.
yes. And just because they're in a smaller body does not mean that they're automatically healthy. And just because somebody's in a bigger body doesn't mean they're automatically unhealthy, or that coming down to a smaller size means that that's what that is. It's because these different things can happen in any body. And chances are, what's happening in these doctor's offices or hospitals or what have you is that they do have that image, because they do tend to get super focused on the number on the scale. They kind of forget everything else about that person, but they focus very hard on that number and make assumptions based off of that. But then the people who come in who are in the smaller bodies, they're like, oh, you know what? You're in a smaller body. Yeah, your blood pressure might be a little bit elevated, but don't worry, you'll be okay. Or here, this is going to be the thing that's actually going to improve your blood pressure. But the person who's in the bigger body, they either get questioned like, how is your blood pressure good? Or, oh, you just need to lose weight in order for that blood pressure to be better. And the fact is that that person might be doing everything in their power to try to do something, and it doesn't mean that that's actually what's affecting their blood pressure, or that keeping that weight off is actually feasible or sustainable, because in most cases it's not.
There are so many
So
variables for sure, but
it
if
is.
we go back, I think in this case, we can circle back to what we were saying before about it's the societal judgment that
Yes.
because you're bigger, you are going to have this, and because you're thinner, no one actually, I mean, people do connect the dots. I mean, I know people who are very thin who have you know, heart attack, who have diabetes, who have metabolic disorder, all the rest of it. But we focus on, you know, larger people. There may be more of a correlation, who knows, but it's not the only reason. And that brings me to, I was going to ask this later, but I actually feels it feels like it needs to be asked now, that you believe that the BMI, the body mass index, has a really sketchy history. Can you tell us what you mean by that?
And before I get to that really quick, I just wanted to touch on that. Oh man, it went right out of my head. Oh well, if it comes back to me, I'll let you know. But
Okay.
sorry.
Happens all the time, don't worry.
It does, right? It really does. But the BMI is a very sketchy piece of it's a very sketchy tool to use because first of all it is a comparison of somebody's height to their weight. It's just a matter of the space that they take up in the world. It doesn't say anything about what's actually happening inside the body. And when it was originally created, it was this guy that was over in Europe, and he was not in the health profession at all. He was actually a mathematician and just liked playing with numbers. And I believe I was listening recently that there was something else going on, like he was trying to help the country stand out. And so they were creating something to make them stand out. But he decided to come up with this way of grouping people based off of numbers. And so he looked at their weight and grouped them based on their weight. This was never ever intended to be an individual marker of success or individual health marker. This was only supposed to be to put people into different groups. And the thing that happened was that the people he measured for that were only other white European males like himself. He never measured any women. He never measured people from other countries, races, cultures, nothing. He just measured other white European males. And so fast forward, maybe about 50, 60 years later. Then over here in the US, the life insurance companies made their own height and weight tables. And their spiel was that if somebody was past this arbitrary line that they drew, that meant that they were at risk for dying sooner. Excuse me. I'm on the phone. Please leave. Thank you. Bye. Shh. Child. Okay, sorry, you might have to edit that part
I
out. The life insurance companies made their tables and they drew the line in the sand that the people who were above that line were at risk for dying sooner. The thing was with their numbers, they only based them on their cherry-picked clientele. They didn't really base it off of any research at the time. And there was this really huge study that was happening by the National Institutes of Health. They were looking at 500,000 men and women, all different aspects of their life that could potentially affect their lifespan. They found out that the people who were at the risk of dying sooner were actually the people in the BMI of 17 to 21, which is technically underweight to halfway into midweight or healthy weight, whatever. And the people who are at risk or the lowest risk for dying early were actually the ones in the bigger bodies. And And if you think about it, the life insurance companies are businesses. And they're in the business to make money. So that meant that if they drew that arbitrary line in the sand, that they could charge people more money or they could deny them care altogether. And unfortunately, our health recommendations were based off those life insurance tables, probably because there was money involved and not necessarily the government's own research project that was on substantially a lot more people. So all of our recommendations were based off that. And then more recently, like within the past 15, 20 years or so, the numbers, like where the healthy weight for BMI, the range of that sits, it used to be higher. It used to be higher. It was actually like, if I recall correctly, it was like around 25.9 or something like that was the higher end of the healthy scale. Well, overnight, they changed it to 24.9. So all this huge group of people that were in that category all of a sudden became overweight overnight. And it was just because they changed the range, you know? So the fact of the matter is that, as I was mentioning before, diet culture and the medical community are closely tied to each other. And the diet industry is a $70 to $80 billion industry every year, and it's always growing. And they like to make money off of our insecurities. And they're in the business for repeat clientele, just like any other business is. So they create these ways of trying to exploit our insecurities, but also when these things don't work, and people wonder why they don't work or they blame themselves for not working, it's really worked into their business model because they want people to keep coming back to them and keep paying them more money, you know? And if any of these different things would work, then we would all be in smaller bodies. But
we're not.
We're not. And there's biological reasons for that and things like that. Can you give me just one quick second? I need to go tell them to be quiet. Give me one second.
From what you were saying, what are we not addressing for why diets don't work?
Well, there's a huge biological component here. In addition to that restriction binge cycle that we talked about earlier, there's also something else that's happening. And it's kind of curious why this isn't really figured, because we apply it to other things in other scientific ways. But one of those things is something that's called homeostasis. It's a big fancy biology word, and it's pretty much, it's where our body functions the best. And it's the range where our bodies survive, because if they go off of any other extremes, that really puts us into survival mode and our body's like, hey, wait a minute, come back to where we are. And we do this with our temperature. We do this with other levels in our body. We have all of these mechanisms to make sure that we stay in the place our body needs to stay. And so what happens is when we are focused, well, like let's call it with the temperature, for example. Let's say that our bodies got too cold. Well, our bodies will start to make a shiver to warm us up, right? Or we might go get a blanket or a sweater or something like that. But if we didn't have that, shivering would be our way of trying to warm ourselves back up. On the opposite side of it, if it's really hot and our temperature is starting to creep up too much, then our body will start sweating to cool us off. Well, and again, same thing with like our other levels within our bodies and things like that. And we also have homeostasis with our weight too. Our weight is largely dependent on genetics, and it also is comprised of other things as well, like our socioeconomic status, our stress level, any medical conditions we have, medications we take, our sleep, whether we've been chronically dieting all of our lives, things like that. But our weight is largely genetic based. And so we have a homeostasis for where that sits. And so what happens is that when we start going on any sort of restriction, our body thinks that we're in starvation mode. And it will do whatever it takes to help us survive. And so, on one side of things, it will make it harder to lose. So you might notice this with one attempt as a plateau with a weight loss, or with every consecutive time that you try to lose weight, it gets harder and harder with each try. On the other side of things, our body wants to make sure that we get enough to eat. So it causes things like stronger hunger cues, cravings, obsessive thoughts about food. And on the other side of things, it makes it easier to put weight back on because it wants to protect us from future famines. And so that's why when we try to lose weight, whatever the process that we use happens, our bodies say, "Hey, wait a minute, why are we doing this? This is where we function. This is where our body's supposed to be." And so we got to do whatever it takes to try to get us back to that place, or it actually happens to end up slingshotting us back in the other direction. And that's why people end up gaining more weight after they've lost weight. And there's been some research that shows that a good percentage, about 80 to 95% of people who try to lose weight in some fashion, that they will regain the weight back or more within 2 to 5 years. And it's not in any fault of their own. But diet culture makes us think that it is our fault because they want to continue exploiting our insecurities and make money off of us and all of that kind of stuff. And what's actually been shown is that there's more impact on trying to fight with our weight and that yo-yo back and forth, the chronic dieting that happens, that actually contributes to more issues with chronic conditions than actually just staying stable in a bigger size.
That's a
So it's just so trying to fight with that. And I know that even though that comes from a place of logic, all of this that I'm sharing, that it kind of feels disappointing and like trying to kill somebody's excitement about getting on the diet bandwagon and everything that goes into it. But that's because what we're trying to fix with our weight is actually probably nothing to do with food and body at all. It's something else that we're trying to gain, and we've just been taught to use food and body as a way of trying to achieve that. And so trying to figure out what that's about and what those inner things are that we're really wanting, that's going to actually help us figure out what's going to be better suited for that. Because trying to do it with diet and food and changing our bodies is really kind of like putting a band-aid on a gaping wound. It's not really going to address what the issue is.
absolutely. I totally agree with you. Like anything, whether you have a disease or whether you have a larger body, whether you're trying to, there's always an emotional component to everything. People don't realize, they don't actually join the dots. They are a lot more now. There's a lot more information out there. There's, it's on social media, it's on the internet. Everyone's starting to understand about the mind-body connection. So that brings me to a question of, like, why do we crave? Is there something that we're trying to feel within other than hunger?
Well, yes, in different ways. I'll put it this way. Because yes, there is the factor of using food to kind of fill like an emotional need. That is definitely a real thing, a coping device that a lot of people use. And including myself, I have always been brought up, that food was there to fix my emotional boo-boos and things like that. I sometimes it comes up, sometimes I'm able to work through it, but and there's absolutely no shame to emotional eating. It really just means that it's a message that something's going on and we need some sort of support. It doesn't mean that we're doing something bad or awful to ourselves intentionally or whatever. It's just something that's
I
going on.
like
And
that. I like that because actually, most people think it is that we're hurting ourselves, that we are being, we're not respecting ourselves, we have no self-esteem. That's what is taught. I like the fact that you said to view it as a message because all symptoms are messages. And even if this is an emotional message that if you are craving or you're eating to the point that you can hardly move or breathe, there's a reason. And that's a message.
And it could be, but it's not necessarily a message with permission to bash yourself about it. It's usually because our inner critic loves having field days with those. But really, it's more of a place to bring some curiosity and some compassion to yourself and figure out what's going on and things like that. And it doesn't mean that food can't be a coping mechanism. It just means that if we only rely on that as a coping mechanism, it might not necessarily help us in every situation where we use it. But there's also another aspect I wanted to touch on about the craving part. Sometimes when we are wanting a particular type of thing, it is because our body is needing it. Like for example, when I'm having my menstrual cycle, a day before it will happen, I will get this really strong craving for chocolate. And that's because I'm, oh, for one thing, I love chocolate. But for another thing, chocolate has magnesium in it, and magnesium helps with cramping. So when I'm about to go and start cramping and stuff like that, my body's like, hey, take some of this. It's gonna help ease your cramps. And maybe there's something else, like if you're getting cravings because you're really hungry. Like if you didn't let yourself eat all day or whatever, you didn't really eat enough to feel satisfied or have energy throughout the day, your body could have cravings for foods that are going to be quick energy sources because it's trying to feed itself as best it can quickly. And so your body does look for those particular types of things. And does that mean that it's a bad thing? No. Does it mean that maybe if we gave you some more food to eat throughout the day, that maybe that wouldn't be as intense or not as convenient all the time? That might be helpful, something to play around with and see what happens. But it doesn't mean that because you're craving that chocolate after working all day without eating, that that means that you've done something wrong,
So that circles back to the good versus bad that we were talking about in the beginning. This podcast is really directed towards people who have gone through conventional medicine or the you were dietitian, have gone to see a nutritionist, gone to a dietitian. They know that they've developed or are developing some form of disordered pattern for themselves around food or thinking, and may have been told just eat less, exercise more, count calories. So for people who have developed or developing that disordered eating and are not receiving the answers or the help they need, you help people to eat intuitively. What do you mean by that? Because that's a different approach than maybe they will receive from someone else. And that's the premise of this is finding people who have a different approach for someone who's just not getting answers and they're frustrated. Let's talk about the intuitive approach.
Yeah, definitely. So intuitive eating is an approach that was developed by Evelyn Tribble and Elise Rush. They're two dietitians, and they've spent 20 years or more looking and researching and figuring all of this out. It's amazing the work that they put together, and it's definitely impacted my life positively for my own personal relationship with food and body, and all of the clients that I help with it too. Intuitive eating is really about turning off all of the noise about everybody telling you how you're supposed to eat or what your body's supposed to look like, because nobody knows how hungry or full you are or what's going to be satisfying for you except for you. And so when the minute that somebody sits there and tries to do that, they actually end up crossing over our personal boundaries. And that's why it feels like we need to have so much willpower, because our body is screaming back saying, "Hey, wait a minute. I'm more hungry than that." Or, "Hey, that food is not what I have available or what I like or what I could tolerate." And so it feels like we have to like shut that off and instead follow what somebody else is saying, because like they know better about our own personal body or our own personal life than we do, which is a bunch of baloney. We as humans, we're born with the ability to be able to know how to feed ourselves. It's part of our survival mechanism. But as we are, like, as we grow older, as our caregivers feed us and take care of us, or as we listen to society, or our medical professionals or whatever, slowly we are taught to not trust what our body is telling us.
I love that.
And so intuitive eating is a way of bringing you back to what that is. And so it's a comprehensive look at our approach to food. And that food neutrality part that we talked about, that's a beginning part of it. Learning how diet culture affects our life is another big part of it, and how it harms. Learning how to identify what our body is saying and how to be able to honor that is another big part of it. If you've been used to turning off those cues just because of avoiding eating or whatever, it might be hard to rely on those right off the bat. We might have to kind of get into a routine, a rhythm of eating, so your body can start to expect the food again. But we also work on things like changing that food police voice that we have into something that's more curious and compassionate. And just be willing to like experiment with things rather than sitting there and bashing ourselves because we did something wrong. There is no wrong with intuitive eating. It's really more about, these different opportunities and being able to figure out, oh, what happened, and how can what happened there that it ended up going in that way? Is there something that I could do that might make that a little easier or a little more supportive? for the next time, but it's not necessarily because somebody made a mistake about something. And
It sounds like it has a
yeah.
lot that the two components in there would be curiosity and compassion. So be
Yeah.
curious why you've done that or why you've repeated the pattern or what emotion has come up for you that triggered you
Yeah.
to grab something that you weren't even hungry for or that you didn't need in the time at that moment. But then look at it and deal with it with compassion instead of judgment and shame.
Exactly. And it doesn't mean that reaching for something was a bad thing, or that it was wrong in any sort of way that needs to be fixed, because maybe it didn't. Maybe it's just that we're so used to thinking that everything that we do is wrong,
Is wrong
and that
when it comes
always
to
have to
food.
be, yeah, and maybe that's not wrong, Maybe that was what was needed in that particular moment, and that's what happened, and it's okay. It's okay. And giving yourself the room to breathe and realize those things and experience those things. Because, when I was growing up, I kept myself on this very high pedestal. My parents, my teachers, all of that. I had to be like the top of everything. I had to, everything had to be perfect. And I never let myself off the hook. And because I felt like if I left myself off the hook, I'd be out of control. People wouldn't like me or whatever the case was. And when I started this self-compassion journey with intuitive eating, it gave me the room to breathe and to be human and to experience things and to not feel like I'm always failing at something or always wrong about something, because I had those unrealistic expectations for myself all the time. And it's okay to be able to enjoy your food. It's not a bad thing. That's Our food is meant to be enjoyed. Otherwise, it'd really be hard to eat if we didn't like our food. So intuitive eating, it's very comprehensive. We also do talk about body neutrality. So, because saying body acceptance and stuff, that can seem like a very far, far, far goal, like a million miles away, for somebody who's been taught to hate their body for so long. And so I work with people taking baby steps towards hating their bodies a little less and coming to a place where you can coexist with your body and not to a place where you feel like you always have to punish it or torture it. We also work on joyful movement, which is, instead of exercise being about punishment or forcing yourself to do things past your limits or doing something you hate or you find boring, or trying to adjust the scale for that matter. If the scale doesn't change, then we think, oh, what was the point of doing all of that? And we stop exercising as a result. Instead, joyful movement is about doing things that you have fun doing that feel good for your body. But it's not about the scale. It's really just about helping your body feel well and work well, and things like that. So my favorite joyful movement is swing dancing. I love swing dancing. It's so much fun, and it's not about the, whatever my body's doing at the time. It's more about the experience, the music, my partner, the dance steps, getting caught up in that moment. That's what it's all about, is that joy, that time. It's not about whether I'm working out at a high enough heart rate or whether the scale is doing what I want it to. It's not anything about that at all. So that's what we work on with joyful movement. And then we also talk about gentle nutrition, which is foods that can help support your body in different kinds of ways, but not necessarily at the expense of others. Because that's what we always think. We always have to swap, We have to take those carrot sticks over cookies any day. We can't, ha have both. Like, it's not a world we can exist in, but in actuality it is. We can enjoy both of those things, and they can be supportive in their own types of ways. So I focus on what can we add instead of what can we subtract.
I like that.
Thank you.
Because of the minute you tell your body, your mind, the minute you say, I can't have, or I need to lose, well, your body doesn't want that. It doesn't want to lose. It doesn't want deprivation. So it's going to psychologically do the opposite. You're going to find that you're going to be running towards the cake or the biscuits or the fried food or whatever it is that you didn't even think of. And you're not going to be going to the fresh fruit, vegetables, and all the rest of it because you don't want that deprivation. So it's the shift of the mindset. And I think that's what you're talking about with your intuitive eating and bringing in the mindfulness. It's like, get away from all of that grabbing at, you know, the next diet pill, the next diet that comes out. What are the scales saying? The scales are attached to my self-worth. You know, I have to, you know, I can't go out in this outfit. I can't be seen in this because, you know, I'll be viewed too big. It's a minefield. And that's what I'm hoping for any of our listeners who are struggling with this disordered thinking, not just eating, it's not just disordered eating, it's also disordered mindset around food and what we shouldn't be doing. You know, I could go on forever.
Me too.
That's what I love about the fact that you're teaching, you know, coming from being a dietitian, you're teaching this intuitive eating, because that's where we start. We have to start with baby steps. We can't just go from, you know, maybe not liking ourselves or not liking the way our body is, so we punish ourselves, to all of a sudden, oh, I'm fantastic, I love myself, my self-worth is great. Yeah. It's not a transition like that. It's tiny baby steps. And
it is very much. And that's something I talk about with people, because diet culture definitely has that mentality that, oh, this will be fixed in 5 weeks or something like that. But this kind of stuff, especially with how long we've been receiving these messages and how much we receive on a daily basis, it's definitely not a light switch. It's not a snap of the fingers. It's being able to have these opportunities and figure out, like, process them and reframe them and be supportive of ourselves in that type of way. So it is a process. It's definitely not a quick.
Yeah, it's definitely a process. And I think it all starts with the emotional side. I also think that as we are promoting on this particular episode, that it's perfectly fine to love yourself as you are. And I think it's perfectly fine to love yourself if you want to be a smaller size, that's perfectly fine too. Everything is okay. It's about the approach, and it's how you do it and how you treat yourself. You know, if
I'm sorry to interrupt you. I was just going to say, yes, people definitely have their own body autonomy and they can make their decisions based on what they need at that time. And if going on a weight loss journey is something they feel that would be what they need, then that's what they, I mean, I don't promote that. I don't necessarily say you need to make sure that you're X amount of weight. But some people need to do that before they are willing to absorb this information, because it's not an easy thing to, like, wrap your brain around, especially if you think that the diet is going to be the answer to all your prayers. And so, yes, having compassion and understanding when people need to go in that direction, that's definitely, you know, understandable. And this stuff that I talk about, it feels like I'm swimming upstream, and some people who are swimming upstream with me, sometimes they get hit by a rock or they hit by another fish swimming upstream, and it gets them going back in the other direction. And it's frustrating, and I wish I could hold on to everybody, but sometimes they need to do that and come back at their own pace. But to be honest with you, our bodies, we're not all meant to be the same size. We're not all meant to look alike. We come from different places all over the world, different genes, different cultures, different things like that. Like, for example, a person from Samoa is going to have a much different body than a person from Japan,
Absolutely, absolutely.
and yeah, my family came from like the Eastern European countries, like Hungary and things like that. So they're bigger people,
There, yeah.
and we're not gonna be smaller people. That's just who our what our genetics are. And the fact is that if we all looked alike, this would be a very boring place,
Absolutely. Absolutely. So for our listeners and the people watching the show who find that they've been on a bit of a roller coaster, they have disordered relationship with food, they may have emotional eating, they want a different